For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, December 14th, the Pass the Phone to Ivanka edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Just a reminder before we get going, we have our call-in show for the holidays. If something in your life is happening and you're not sure if it's sexist, if it's something you're doing or someone you know is doing, we will figure that out for you. Call in 929-266-8195. That's 929-266-8195. And we are recording the show early, so call right away if you hear this number, and we will play your voice on air and then answer the question. Okay, our topics for this week. First, Trump's cabinet and what it means for women. Second, self-care, how the term has evolved over the years. And third, mom is apparently now a compliment. Okay, I don't really believe it, but we'll get to that. And then our Slate Plus segment. June, you want to tell us about it?
We will be deciding whether lingerie is sexist.
Heavy-hitting yes. Issues today.
Yes, heavy-hitting issues, and we're all dressed in lingerie for that segment.
Picture
if you're not a Slate Plus member, just picture it in your head. You can start your free... I got lingerie and bow tie there for a minute. If you're not a Slate Plus member, you can start your free 2-week trial by visiting slate.com/xxplus to support all the great work that Slate does. All right, our first topic, Trump's cabinet. I guess in my head, this one is a report card and it has categories, you know, like mm-hmm. First is just the basic optics. You count the number of women. That one's going to be easy. And then there's the bro culture, you know, some of the bro-y things many of them have done. And then we have to get to the actual policies mm-hmm. that they might do. You know, there's just like lots of ways. The Ivanka factor, right? That's like the extra credit.
And spoiler alert, none of this is going to make anybody happy, except, I guess, misogynist Republicans.
Yeah, he's going to get an F. Speaking of misogynist, I have to say I've been getting like a lot. The misogynist uprise in my sort of like Twitter through my email, it's really been noticeable.
Oh, really?
It's mostly from the end of men, but it's like it was quiet for a long time. And now it's just like, whoosh.
Wow.
Some people have just found their megaphone again. Like, welcome back, assholes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like they are, you know, they're totally empowered to get back at me for a book I wrote 5 years ago. It's really important.
What do they say? Okay, we're still here?
No, it's so bad. Like, I just forward you one of them. We're Still Here is A, English, B, grammatical, and three, it doesn't have, you know,
a slur.
The words like, yeah, exactly. Ugh. So no, not that. All right, well, let's get going. Where do we start? Let's start with the numbers. There are some women in the mix, we got to say, just in the pure optics. There's mm-hmm. Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education, right?
Mm-hmm. The charter school advocate who destroyed Detroit's public schools and has never been to a public school in her life, basically. So that's number
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I did some deep reading into Betsy DeVos, and it really, for some reason, she's the one who tipped me over the edge of all of them.
Yeah, she bugs me.
Because she really, like, the Detroit Free Press has done a lot of great reporting on how she's destroyed the Michigan public schools, so that's one. But the Christian angle was one I was not quite aware of. Like, I wasn't aware that this was part of sort of a larger conspiracy, that her family funds the Family Research Council, and this is the bigger picture is that public schools are, you know, destroying Christianity.
I didn't know that either. I thought it was like a free market thing.
It's terrifying.
No. Wow.
Yes, yes. No, it's not a free market thing. It's like a Christian thing, you know? We just believe that the public schools are like secular, you know, are pushing a secular agenda. It's not that charter schools don't, but it's just like kill the public schools because they're poisoning our children's mind with secular nonsense.
Wow.
So, welcome, Betsy.
Is Elaine Chao over the, what, transportation?
Yeah, yeah, Secretary of Transportation. Yeah.
Mitch McConnell.
Mrs. Mitch McConnell. Yeah. But that's all right. That's like a link to the Republican. Now what we're wishing for is links to the regular Republican establishment. That's the thing
what
that
a
we
world when
like, yearn for.
When a connection to Mitch McConnell is like a yes, thank goodness.
Yes, exactly.
Well, she's been in other administrations. Yeah. She's a respected
experienced
bureaucrat.
She knows how Washington works. She's been in that swamp for quite some time and knows how to swim in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's not like opposite world with her. Perry, let's put the guy who wanted to destroy the thing in charge and couldn't even remember its name in charge of it. Like, it's not a backwards opposite situation.
Right. Or a guy who's suing the department being put in charge of it. Yeah, it's not one of those.
Yeah. Nikki Haley. Okay, she removed the Confederate flag. She said many, you know, progressive things.
What department has she got?
She's the ambassador to the UN.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, Hannah, you profiled her, right? Does she have any international experience on her resume?
Zero.
Okay.
Absolutely none. That's the different part of Trump's brain, which is like, oh, that person looks foreign. Let's put them in charge of foreign things. She's not foreign. Like, she grew up her whole life in the South, right? So, but that's the, you know, that's like the, that's the other part of his brain. It's, that's the optics part of his brain.
Right.
Nor is she progressive in general. You know, it's that she did grow up an immigrant in a very white place, and so she has consciousness. She did do an amazing thing when she won. I mean, just by winning against a pretty entrenched Southern white male establishment. So she's got that experience, even though her politics are conservative. Okay, so there's the women. Now we.
It sounds like we're doing a pageant, like Trump's women of the cabinet.
We could do a calendar, you guys.
It would be three pages. and then the rest of the months would just be Ivanka.
Or nine bald guys.
Right, or nine bald guys. Okay, so now we have to get to the bro culture, which would be Andrew Puzder, the Carl's Jr. guy.
Now, I edited a piece written by Christina Cotarucci last week about his attitudes to the Carl's Jr. ads, which I was not aware of, not being much of a consumer of TV ads, but they often, you know, they're your basic kind of sexist bikini, you know, wearing women, which is a strange trope, I guess, for hamburgers, maybe not. And he has this weird thing where, you know, he defends his use of bikinis because, like, hey, that gets people to buy burgers. Fine. It's kind of repulsive, but it's also like, hello, capitalism. But he has this phrase that he keeps using, which Christina highlighted how frequently he used it. And it became so skeevy to me that it actually was one of the creepiest things I've experienced, like, in quite some time, which in this last month is quite an achievement. He keeps saying young, hungry guys.
Oh, yeah.
And he says it over and over and over again. And he'll say it multiple times in a sentence. And after a while, I just like, what role does young, hungry guys play in his cosmology? Like, inside his head, is it just like young, hungry guys gone wild? It's just so peculiar.
It's his consumer.
I urge you all to read that Christina Carter blog post. It's very funny, and we'll post it on our show page. But it did start to seem homoerotic after a while, like the number of times he said young, hungry guys.
Yeah.
Can I read another quote from Puzder that she had? "We believe in putting hot models in our commercials because ugly ones don't sell burgers." All right.
Can I tell you?
Do you really have to spell that out?
So, can I tell you a side note about Carl's Jr.'s commercials? A friend of mine in LA had an apartment that like looked out on the house next door, and they were filming something in the backyard, and he thought it was a porn because it was Los Angeles, and it turned out to be a Carl's Jr. commercial because it was just so similar.
Wow, porn or Charles Jr. commercial?
Well, porn. That's a really
good
meme,
game,
porn,
right?
Carl's Jr. So, June, I thought you were going to say something else funny that Christina pointed out, which is that he kept saying that these Carl's Jr. bikinis. So it's one thing. It's like maybe you're like a good, you know, whatever. You're a guy and you think this is how you sell burgers, and so you do that thing. But he kept saying that those bikini ads are a reflection of his personality.
Right.
What does
and
that
he was
mean?
Proud of that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
A reflection of my personality. That's such a funny thing to say.
I mean, I guess that it's another one of these anti-PC things, you know, that he's not just like, hey, yeah, come on, guys. Models in bikinis sell hamburgers. Like, he's proud of it and he loves it and he wants the world to know that. And I guess his pride in it is what makes it his personality. And I mean, yeah, it does say everything we need to know about him, I suspect.
Guys, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How many people in the Trump orbit have been accused of assaulting women?
At least four.
Yeah. Including this guy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's his ex-wife, right?
His ex-wife.
Sexual harassment. Steve Bannon.
Steve Bannon's ex-wife. Corey Lewandowski was not prosecuted, but you know, assaulted a reporter during the campaign. And then
Trump himself.
Trump.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. This is funny and also really depressing.
Yeah. Let's just take a moment, though, to say that at a certain point, there were more men who had been accused of sexually assaulting women than women in his orbit.
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
Oh, wow.
At one point, like, obviously, no, that's no longer true, but.
Are you sure that's no longer true?
Well.
If we just counted three people in the, I guess if you would count the Hope Hicks and the Kellyanne Conway and
because Lewandowski kind of complicates things because he's a little attenuated at this point, but certainly the numbers are it's yet another example of something where in a normal world, you know, you wouldn't have one because that would be a disqualifying situation, and it's clearly not in this world.
Okay, so here's my question about all of this. So. Functionally, what will this mean for women, right? What can
That's
the executive
question.
Branch
yeah,
do?
Right.
Well, there's Jeff Sessions, right? Very mm-hmm. anti-abortion attorney general. So that is something that could be serious and has already emboldened. Boy, that's this thing you usually read in the newspaper, but has already, you know, made a space, let's say, for states to start passing abortion laws that they otherwise wouldn't. Or would think just wouldn't hold water, right?
Yeah. Like Ohio, for instance, this week tried to pass the heartbeat bill, where as soon as you can hear a heartbeat at 6 weeks, abortion becomes illegal. And John Kasich vetoed it, but did pass a 20-week ban.
Right. Which still is possibly unconstitutional, probably unconstitutional, but we also have, because of just a hideous thing that happened this year, where there's still a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And so the chances of a anti-choice Supreme Court justice seem to be just about 100%.
Right.
So that's obviously the underpinning worry.
So here's the thing, though. Donald Trump is not really anti-abortion, right? Like, during the campaign, he said that he was. But He has a long history as a pro-choice person, right? I guess the politically expedient thing for him to do, he's going to be getting a ton of pressure from, for instance, his vice president. But I think that will be interesting to see. Like, does he prioritize that?
Well, looking at his appointments, it sure seems that way. I mean, you know, he claims continuously that he's pro-LGBTQ. He made that shout out at the convention, and yet he has appointed several really virulent and prominent anti gay rights people, including his vice president. So, you know, I keep asking myself that too, because I always saw him as someone who had no ideology, but his appointments are extraordinarily ideological and all the same ideology.
Mm.
It's true. I've always assumed it's a deal he made with Mike Pence, you know, that would have to be one of his priorities for Mike Pence to be vice president. But it's true. Sometimes, you know, what you can't decide, you know, so initially it was just this erratic, inappropriate behavior. And now it's become a kind of solid block of conservative ideology, which is a slightly different thing that you're facing. Mm-hmm. You know, like Tom Price, who hates the Affordable Care Act, you know, the way he talks about birth control. Bring me one woman who's been left behind. There's not one, he says, about women having trouble affording birth control. All right. So so the last thing we have to talk about is Ivanka and what difference Ivanka will make to all of this.
I mean, well, let's tell the story that was the kicker of Margaret Talbot's piece in The New Yorker about Trump's appointments, where he had a conversation with Nancy Pelosi. And when she started to talk about women's issues, he handed the phone to Ivanka. And after, you know, in a year where I just keep thinking, oh, my God, how perfect is he in his awfulness? Somehow that seems right up there. That's just right
it's
up true. There.
It's just like the vision of it is fabulous. You know?
I delegate.
Oh,
so
you're a woman.
Don't talk to me about woman stuff.
So what if Ivanka gets us paid family leave? That's like is that a deal with the devil that's worth making?
I mean, better to have it than not, right? But it's not about Obama. It's about insurance companies. But like my healthcare is so expensive and so awful. Like that, to make it even worse is something that it just seems unimaginable. Although paid parental leave would finally put us in the realm of developed nations, there's so much else that is potentially so awful that I can't take too much thrill in it. However, yes, it does seem like it would be a really good thing. Better to do it than
But you have to answer Noreen's question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Deal with the devil.
All know it's good.
Yeah, but the devil is already there. What's to decide? I mean, the devil's there. Will we take it or not? Yeah, we'll take it. But what's the choice?
Well, it's so interesting. It's just like I feel like every conversation we've had on this podcast for the past few years where we talk about, you know, what can we really fix? That's been sort of the answer, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say that happens, that 6 weeks paid family leave becomes the law of the land. But also Roe v. Wade is overturned and like, you know, half the states in the country decide to ban abortion. Like what does the feminist
you will not take that. That's too much.
Okay, so let's say, but that's
a couple of states.
Okay, so.
But you guys, we don't get to choose this. Like, it's happening. That's what's going to happen, maybe. I mean, the only way that would not happen would be if the family leave stuff didn't happen. Because all the rest, it's just inevitable at this point. Don't you think?
An erosion of Affordable Care Act is probably inevitable. An overturning of Roe versus Wade, not inevitable.
Not inevitable. But there will be more and more underminings of it in the way that's been happening in the last few years.
And I guess I also don't believe that we're going to get paid family leave.
Yeah,
that's what I was just going to ask.
So many, because you've got like Exxon, Carl's Jr. You know, I mean, the people that you have in the cabinet are not people who generally support, sort of welfare-minded business. And then finally, Christian conservatives are not that into paid family leave because it solidifies a vision of a world in which women are working, which women are working and poor women are working, but they don't like that to be kind of hardened in public policy. So there's likely to be a blowback for that reason.
I also think she might drop it once her book promotion is done. I really do.
That's
call me cynical, but let's check back in 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah, but maybe. But even if we did get it, you know, we have unpaid family leave. I think I'll wait a few years for paid family leave. I won't take the deal with the devil. I know I don't have a choice, June. I'm just pretending that I have a little bit of empowerment here. But
so I was just checking. I'm like, wait, can we do this? Can we get to vote again?
Everything's a negotiation. He's a deal maker.
He's a deal maker. And Planned Parenthood, I tend to think is not going to get a very good deal in the coming years.
Yeah.
Terrifying. Yeah.
Anyway, okay, so that's so we got an F there, just the way we predicted that we would.
So there are no bright spots. We can't think of anything.
No bright spots.
Okay,
I cannot think of any.
It seems like
bright spots for women.
It does seem too like maybe I'm being naive, but it does seem worse than I had imagined. I mean, just in the way that we always hold on to this hope that, you know, the Laura Bush hope that. Oh, she's smart. She reads books. She'll, you know, talk him down from some of his crazier positions. And there was a sort of a version of this was Trump's not really all that far right. And we're seeing it doesn't matter what Trump is or isn't. It's a very right wing administration.
Well, it's almost an anarchist cabinet. That is what really got me. Setting aside women's issues on top of everything else, just the climate stuff, just mm-hmm. every single cabinet appointment that came down, it was like salt in the wound, mm-hmm. you know? It just mm-hmm. made you think just every single time it went backwards and backwards and backwards. And I think the cabinet appointments have been really tough to watch.
Yes.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. I agree with June. Like, you somehow thought, oh, he's in New York. Or at least there was a little part of your brain that thought he doesn't really believe a lot of this stuff. And maybe in his kind of the erratic way that he makes choices in his life, you know, there'll be some that sneak in there that aren't totally destructive. But this seems like a wall of destruction.
Elaine Chao.
Yes.
Elaine Chao. That's right. As we're hanging on to you, Elaine. Elaine,
you're our
us.
Last hope.
Yeah.
She's probably like not nice.
But there's always pictures of her and Mitch McConnell smiling, you know?
Yeah.
Ha-ha.
Yeah.
Like they have a wonderful marriage. That's what the picture seemed to say. Okay, go Elaine. Go Elaine. That's what we got. We will check in again on Trump's cabinet and Trump probably every 2 weeks, but at least for a while.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
All right, let's go to our second topic, self-care. The term self-care exploded in the week after Trump was elected. Yoga, fortifying foods, things you're supposed to do with your friends. The phrase hovers somewhere between a political term, a marketing ploy, just common sense, you should take care of yourself, or self-parody, which I'm suspecting is Noreen's view. we discuss the evolution of self-care. So should we do this historically? Because there were bits of history here that I didn't know. Like how it popped up as a 90s political
thing. Yeah. I knew the history actually because I tried to assign a piece on this a couple of years ago when I saw this coming up on sort of feminist blogs. It sort of came out of activism that you couldn't sort of fight the larger struggle if you weren't taking care of yourself, and that self-care was a practice that activists ought to pay attention to. And I think also it's like a mental health thing too, that it's become sort of a depression thing, like self-care. But the reason I was interested in trying to assign a piece on it was that where I have seen it used is like, put on a face mask, that's self-care, or like spend that $35 on SoulCycle, it's self-care, which is sort of like, come on. So now everyone knows my views on the self-care phenomenon.
Wait, but why can't you divide those things? So, mm-hmm. of course, everything gets commercialized. All of political statements eventually get commercialized. So just to break that down, like, do you believe it was a legitimate? Let's start as a political term. Like, June, this is like, is that a legit political, you know, this is Audre Lorde, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it's self-preservation, it's an act of political warfare. So that sounds to me a little bit like 70s. Like there's a journey inwards that you have to make, mm-hmm. and that journey allows you to, you know, take care of the world. I guess for me, the question is like, well, how long is the journey going to take? Do you know what I mean? Like if the journey is going to take you your whole life, then it is self-indulgence. But if the journey is like about putting on an armor so that you can then go out and do something, you have to then go out and do something. Like, isn't this the thing, the Trump conversation we had the other week? Like, you can hide under your blankets and just sort of read a novel and eat popcorn for some amount of time, but that doesn't ultimately count as a political act unless you then, you know, emerge with your armor and do a political act, right? Or not.
I do think that's the important distinction, that it is almost a mental health thing. It's not a lifestyle. It's not what you do for a living. It's something that you do to take care of yourself. I mean, I feel like the term self-care probably doesn't need a whole lot of like, explanation. But I mean, yeah. Or, you know, anytime you quote Audre Lorde, I'm forced to agree. But also I think that, you know, the fact that Audre Lorde has something to say about that comes from a time when poets were also our political gurus. I mean, a poet will, of course, be interested in looking inside one's head and you know, finding balance and all of those things. I mean, I just think, especially at this time of year when everybody's working extra hard, trying to get, you know, those, whatever the equivalent is in your own world of trying to bank a lot of stories before people take off on vacation, you have to take a pause. You have to put your mask on before you can help others. But this isn't just about putting your mask on. It's about putting your mask on and helping others. You do have to do that second thing, too.
Are we talking like a mm-hmm. Dead Sea salt scrub mask? What kind of mask are we talking about? No, really.
Marianne is just listening to this whole conversation.
No, I think you're right. But okay, so we're talking about this because the New York Times Style section ran a piece by Marissa Meltzer on the rise of it in the post-Trump era. And she quotes she says on Instagram, the tag hashtag self-care has well over a million posts, including images of sliced persimmons, clay face masks, and many yoga poses. And I'm being a little harsh on it. I do think that like something like yoga probably does qualify as self-care. I think that Audre Lorde would not be happy with the way it's been, taken over by the capitalist marketers, probably.
Yeah. But it's not just capitalists. Isn't it feminists, too? Like, isn't there a little cocoon sometimes mm-hmm. that people try and create around it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think you can politicize anything now, right? And that's the danger and the beauty. You can, any sort of act of, frankly, any act of like selfish feminine pampering, you could argue you're reclaiming that as a woman in the world, you're not supposed to like do that for yourself, that you're supposed to be taking care of other people. I think that's one argument.
Wait, say
for
that
it.
Again? I didn't understand that.
Like in a world where as a woman, you're supposed to be taking care of other people, whether, you know, as a mother or at work, you're doing emotional labor or whatever, sort of reasserting your own importance in mm-hmm. the world is an act of radical feminism. You could argue that. And I think that is some of the philosophy underlying this. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe part of it is I live a life where I live an essentially self-focused life. And so for me, I don't think that self-care is my issue.
Right.
It's sort of getting out of myself more. But I understand that other people might be in a totally different place. And a term that I've found useful, actually, which is probably basically the same thing, but it has not been co-opted by marketers. But sometimes when I'm like down or upset or super busy or sick, my mother will say, well, you need to mother yourself. Mm. And to me, that means like be like a little gentle and forgiving on yourself, but ultimately sensible. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think my mother's version of mothering yourself is like go get a manicure and, you know, eat some chocolate. So sometimes I like repeat that to myself in those moments, which I guess is the same.
So it doesn't involve product.
Like it doesn't involve product.
No product.
Yeah. Right. It's like be a little easier on yourself and do something healthy and good.
Yeah. Don't burn yourself out is ultimately what it boils down to. Or if you are frazzled, take a moment. Don't get more frazzled. I don't think you need to have done a lot of psychological study to figure out why this is necessary.
Right.
So there are two places where self-care makes sense to me. Like, mostly I'm with you, Noreen. It's like I see the ads and you're like, really? Like pomegranate, you know? So the Hairpin has the self-care column. And, you know, when you read specific entries like self-care and depression. You know, some of them are about smoother skin or whatever. But they're generally about people going through a rough patch, women going through a rough patch, and then going easy on themselves. Like, the title self-care makes you cringe, but in its specificity, mm-hmm. like in the specific story of a single person who is going through something and then needs to kind of chillax, it makes total sense, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's a bunch of good ones on the hairpin self-care column. The other thing is the mom thing, which we're about to talk about. But there is a way in which women are expected to take care of people and take care of things and host and generally be caretaking. And so I don't know that I consider self-care a radical act, but I do consider it a hard-won space. I wish it wasn't called self-care because something about that term is off. But maybe I'll use your mom's term, you know?
Mother yourself.
Go mother yourself or something like that. Like,
you have to be careful how you say it.
That seems, you go mother yourself.
Yeah, I don't mean to be too harsh on it. I think that I am reacting to the hashtag version of this.
Right.
And the essential mm-hmm. thing is good.
Right. There's a difference, too, between self-care and treat yourself.
Right.
You know, which right. is a great fun thing to do, but it's not really self-care.
Right. Right. I mean, for right. some people, like self-care might be not treating yourself.
Right.
And I think that's like the place where I am in my life. And so that's partly where I'm having that reaction.
Oh, what do you mean it's not treating yourself?
You mean because you live a life in which you can... I think I'm too self-indulgent. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think yeah. I should be harder on myself.
Oh, my God. You should do more for others.
You should
others.
Work till 10:30, not just till 10.
Anyway.
You should pick up my children from school sometimes. All right. Well, listeners, how about this? Can you tell us what you do for self-care that isn't hashtag self-care? Like, that isn't, you know, pomegranate face lotion or whatever. And if it is pomegranate face lotion, just fight back and tell us why that is actually and should count as self-care and we should shut up. All right. Our final topic, moms. This used to be a lame thing, like mom jeans or mom hair or whatever. And now mom is the highest form of flattery. So the list of people that we call mom now, Beyonce, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Selena Gomez. Like, that really confused me. When I got to Selena Gomez and Kylie Kendall, I was like, what?
Wait, but how, who's
like
calling?
12 years old.
Who's calling
who's
these
calling
people mom?
Them mom?
It's teens, right?
Teens. Well, that was a funny thing because when I tweeted out, who do you call, like, who do you call mom who's not your mom? The answers I got were completely wrong. So I realized, like, I just don't have, I was trying to get the demographic. I was like, I just don't have 13-year-old followers. Like, if my daughter had tweeted it, she would have gotten the appropriate answers. Instead, I got answers that were like, there's this aunt that I really love and she's wonderful. And I call, I was like, no, that's not what I meant, you know? So I think it is really young.
Yeah.
Right.
And this is another New York Times piece we're discussing by Jessica Bennett, sort of pinning this trend, which has sprung up over the past couple of years. And this also actually goes back to someone named Lord, but Lord, the teen pop star, not the like feminist poet.
Activist poet. Yeah.
And I guess the origin story of mom as a piece of current slang in popular usage goes back to, as many things do, Kim Kardashian, right? So she posted on Instagram the picture of her on Paper Magazine with her, like, how would you describe it? Her
glistening
ass.
And the champagne, the Break the Internet cover. And Lord just tweeted at her and said, mom. And people were like, are you, like, talking about her post-mom body?
You know, saying that moms shouldn't pose like that?
Yeah, in this very Us Weekly way. And she was like, no, like, mom is the highest praise in teen speak. So how much
she
is
said, adopt me. Oh, be my second adopt mom. Me. Yes. It adopt means me. Adopt me. Be my second mom. I think of you as a mother figure. You are so epic. That's what Lord said. When she explained herself, it was like, it means you are epic.
So it's not ironized. It's earnest, right? Or am I wrong?
Yeah.
No, I think it's
no, earnest. No. Totally earnest. Totally like you are epic. Straight.
So.
Yeah.
I don't. Okay, so you have a teenage daughter.
So what does it mean? Does it mean that teenagers like are really actually into their moms, or it means that teenagers actually hate their moms and they want other moms that are more cooler moms? Or like, does it tap in? You know, there are times in culture when moms, you know, become the savior, like the awesome figure. And I don't know why that slipped in. Like, is that because of Hillary? But it predates Hillary. Like, yeah, how did it become, how did mom become the thing? It doesn't make any sense to me. I just find it confusing. And also, I feel like it's a, like it's designed to trip me up. Like, somebody will be like, hey, mom. And I'll be like, yeah, he called me mom. And then it turns out it's like the security guard telling me that, like, my kid is about to get hit by a car. Like, it just seems like it's designed to, you know, it's designed to trip me up.
I don't think people verbalize it. I'm going to say that. I think it's fully an internet thing. Like, it's a comment you would leave. I don't think you would be like, you look so mom in those jeans. I don't think it's become, I think it's just pretty specific to that space.
That's the first thing my daughter said. She's like, nobody has ever said that
yeah,
out loud.
Yeah.
Like, nobody ever says that. Because I told her we were talking about this. It's like, do your friends ever? She's like, no, you would never say that out loud.
Right, exactly. It's just, that's why I think, I think it's an interesting mix of earnest and ironic, actually. Because I think, like, okay, the reasons why, like the mother as the ultimate figure in just human consciousness is pretty baked in, right? So of course on some level it's like a compliment, and especially when you're a teenager, you are not so distant from that. But also something that you would never say out loud, it is ironized a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's just like,
right, the fact that you don't say it out loud means that there's a reason for that.
Yeah, it's like...
But ironized how? What's the irony? Is it like you're sort of... Is it a way of saying even Taylor Swift is old, or what's the irony?
Yeah, I don't think it's about old. It's like, clearly, if you comment Taylor Swift mom, then you're not saying... There's no literal concept involved, but you are somehow present. To be honest, Taylor Swift is the least... is the person whose momness I am least convinced by. But, it totally makes sense to me. As you've both said, you know, there's something so fundamental and so central to life itself in motherhood that even, you know, if this is a teen thing, and if even if teens are having problems with their own mothers and, you know, oh, my mom is so whatever, they still, as you say, appreciate the importance of the mom, and they still in some way venerate the role of the mother. I do think, too, that it's a kind of an alternative to girl crush, which has become problematized, as the kids say these days. It's like momming is the ultimate no homo. Like, it's not involving, you know, weird people. Nobody's going to say, oh, you're momophobic for, you know, calling someone mom in the way that, you know, people felt that saying someone was your girl crush was a little bit homophobic, because what? You have to separate it from actually having a crush. You know, there was that kind of pushback, which I never truly understood. But whereas mom is like...
Mom is
never sexy. There's no sex involved.
But sometimes it's used... But like in the Kim Kardashian thing, it was sexy.
Right. But I mean, it was sexy in the sense of like confusing it with saying, I want you. You know, like it's...
Right.
Whereas daddy, on the other hand, has lots of sexual...
Yeah, daddy's having a moment, too.
Is it?
For sure.
Mom and daddy are different in that sense. And it's just
pure on you inspire me. Like, if she had tweeted girl crush to that naked picture, I see what you mean. It has, like, weird undertones. But if you say mom, it just means...
It just means respect.
You inspire me. Respect. You know, respect that you did that. I want to do that too one day. You're my inspiration.
I think.
And maybe, or whatever.
Yeah, maybe you're just on like a different plane, you know, like you're an adult, even if you're like a young one like Selena Gomez or whatever, you're just like
you've got your stuff figured out.
Yeah.
Because that's another mom trait. It's like you're organized, you know, you're mature. It's, and obviously not every mom is, but that I guess those other moms wouldn't get hashtag mommed.
Right.
Do you think Beyonce likes it? Like when somebody tweeted, Beyonce just ended your mom's cause. It's like Beyonce is like the ultimate mom. Do you think she likes it?
Well, that came in response to a very sweet photo of her in blue. So I imagine like if you put that photo out there, then sure.
You are actually a mom.
I mean,
why not?
It seemed like she was really proud and really happy about that image, and she's the one who showed it to the world.
I also think teenagers do think of Beyonce as a mom. Like, really? I don't think they're as ironized when they call her a mom. Like, I think Beyonce is sort of, adults think Beyonce is cooler than teenagers think Beyonce is.
Huh.
Right. Interesting.
That's so what my teen correspondent didn't tell me.
Now, what about the drag history? That was interesting, too. Like, do all words get kind of like, they all get traced back to drag culture?
I swear every New York Times style section story, there's a compulsory inclusion.
Do you think it's true, though? So I didn't quite follow how this one made the leap. Maybe I'm wrong. But so in drag, like the you call someone a mother or father who is...
People generally have drag mothers, often have drag mothers who like show them the ropes, who teach them, you know, both the lingo and the, you know, maybe issues around clothing and makeup and just kind of bring them into the life. And so it's not quite the same. I mean, it's yes.
But
so
maybe it
so
is.
Calling someone your drag mother, I mean, it's a you only have one typically.
But you would never say drag mom, or would you?
I've never heard that, but I'm not totally involved in that world, so I'm not sure. But it does seem to be that people say drag mother. We had a lovely piece in Outward a couple of Mother's Days ago from Ms. Cracker, who has been a guest on our show, that talked, it was a tribute to her drag mother, Bob the drag queen.
It does make sense that like that would be like sort of how you want to emulate the way like Taylor Swift presents herself. I mean, I don't, but one might, you know, or the way Kim Kardashian presents herself.
And I mean, I was going to say something that when you were talking about Taylor Swift, like you don't necessarily want to mimic her look or her style. It's about the way she, as you said, her sort of self-presentation, the way that she seems so together and so in charge. With Kim Kardashian, there's a little bit of that. And then there's also some, you know, like wow body kind of, you know, almost like a non-sexual catcalling of like, yeah, you're looking good, you know, that element of it. But I do think it's about the togetherness that we associate with momness.
Well, then I see that. Then I see the drag analogy. It's just, you know, teach me, you know, can I learn to be like that, to look like that, to put myself out there like that? All right, I'll take it. I get it.
Could you ever see yourself using this, like making a comment on a Instagram photo or in a tweet? Would you ever say, "Mom"?
No.
Me? Jesus, no. No.
I think at what point do you stop using new slang? And like, I think there's a certain point where you start to feel ridiculous. And I don't feel that way about all slang, but something like mom, I would look thirsty. I feel comfortable using thirsty. I would look thirsty putting mom on someone's Instagram.
Yeah.
I think you should try it. Just do it as an experiment. Do it to like some of your colleagues at work, and you know, when they post things, just like comment like that and see how people respond.
I'll just reply all to like emails about what we should put in the magazine.
You know, that reminds me, I've never ever done it to a woman, but I have had like the one work relationship that I've had that I would ever consider something like a mentor relationship was with Jack Schaefer. And I started calling him dad even before he was literally a dad. And there's not that many years between us, actually. So it was always a little bit strange. And I still sometimes call him dad. And that felt very normal and natural.
How did that start? You just one day were like, hey, dad, what should I do with this piece?
I think probably it was an email or something, you know. It was something that just, you know, happened without planning. And I can't imagine ever doing that. And that was a very specific weird guy and a very specific, you know, situation and relationship. But I can't imagine that it would ever be okay to do that with a woman that I work with, especially because, like, yeah, he really is, like, you know, not that much older than me. And it would have been, I would have been insulting a woman by calling her mom, whereas it wasn't an insult to him. He knew, you know, whatever.
It would also feel so emotionally creepy to call like a mentor figure your mom. I don't know. But watch out on your Instagrams, guys. I might be dropping some moms in the comments.
I was wondering if I could force the younger people who work for me at Invisibilia to call me mom. You can't do that. It has to rise up organically,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
I can't like announce it in a PowerPoint. Be like, from now on.
This is a piece of self-care I'm doing for myself. I'm going to ask everyone here to call me mom.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, I'm guessing, you know, maybe we have teenage listeners who want to tell us who you call
mom. We've alienated them all.
We've alienated them all, but if you're out there and you want to tell us who you call mom, that's not on the list we already mentioned, please write in and do that. Okay, well, that's our show. Let's move on to recommendations. June, what do you have for us today?
I would like to recommend something that's quite New York-centric, but it's an exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York called Gay Gotham, Art and Underground Culture in New York, and it is really good. It is two floors of the museum, and it's kind of organized around some people and neighborhoods. There's a really cool kind of feature where they focus on, they show maps of neighborhoods and show some kind of iconic gay moments or gay places that happened in those spaces. There is quite a focus on the underground art scene, which is also always nice to see. But it's a really good exhibit, and I really recommend taking that trip uptown. And you can also, if you have time, you can also pop next door to El Museo del Barrio, and they also often have really good exhibits, although I have not seen their current offerings.
Yeah, that museum is good, the Museum of the City of New York. I've been a few times and always been really impressed.
That sounds great. I'm actually taking my family to New York for the holidays, so maybe I will do just that. All right. This movie does not need my recommendation because everybody's praised it already. But Manchester by the Sea, I do think, is the best movie I've ever seen.
Whoa.
I really think it's amazing. Wow. Now, unfortunately, I came home the night after I watched it. And kind of Google dived on Casey Affleck's sexual assault allegations. Mm. So that's a whole other thing. And maybe we need to discuss that, because there's just like that long Daily Beast blow by blow of how he was accused of treating these couple of women who worked for him, which is not pretty. And so his acting is so amazing in this movie. So your mind has to do that thing, like, what do you forgive? You know, I kind of wish I hadn't done that, but I did do that. But it's just amazing.
It's interesting what sticks and what doesn't stick. Mm-hmm. That hasn't really become a big story.
And I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because, like, it's not a rape charge like Nate Parker. It didn't go through the courts. It is pretty detailed. Like, there's just, you know, lots of details, and it's kind of relentless. You know, it's just like relentless, made it really, really unpleasant for these couple of women who were working with him to be able to work with him.
I think the fact that he's an actor, I mean, a lead actor in the movie, but like, he's not the producer and writer and director and the, you know, sort of multi-hyphenate that Nate Parker was with Birth of a Nation.
So what, we expect them to behave like children because they're actors?
No, by no means. But that, just in terms of, you know, affecting the reception of the entire movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, he is an actor in this film. He didn't write it. He didn't direct it. He didn't, you know, so it's his contribution may, you know, maybe his acting makes the movie, you know, 100% different, but his role in it, you know, he's one factor of many, whereas Nate Parker really was Birth of a Nation in many ways.
Yeah, and I guess it's a little different from Woody Allen. Anyway, we don't have to have a whole other discussion, but it's such an amazing movie. If that's way too heavy for you, I have another problematic recommendation, which is the Carpenizer 2017 calendar, which I have not stopped looking at. It's the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Wait,
it's
what calendar?
It's a sexy carp calendar. So, of course, this is defined by my daughter, because she reads the Daily Mail every day, and they're so funny. But it's women posing with carp. Sexily, like the Sports Illustrated calendar, but with giant fish. It's really freaking funny. And it's not exactly meant as a joke. It's made by a carp gear retailer called Carpenizer. And it's designed for carp fishermen to put up in their, you know, fishing house or whatever. It's unbelievably hilarious. And I've been wondering all week whether I'm allowed to buy it, even though it's just totally sexist. But it's just so funny.
If only anyway. You could call into a call-in show and get advice from some
That's literally unqualified. What I do. Can I buy the Carbonizer calendar? It gives me so much pleasure and it's so sexist.
I think it would count as self-care.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Self-care. Anyway, okay, Noreen.
I have a recommendation about a podcast about a problematic man. So Startup, which is a podcast from Gimlet Media, which I think is on its third or fourth season at this point, and has been good in all of its seasons, but I have really loved this season, where they are following Dove Charney, the infamous ex-CEO founder of American Apparel, who's trying to start a new t-shirt apparel line, who was accused of all kinds of gross acts against his employees, and essentially had to step down. And he gave them tons of access. And they've done tons of reporting with women who worked for him, who, you know, had accused him of things, who had settled with him. And they are really painting a picture of how something like this happens, how a company functions and doesn't function when someone like this is at the center of it, the kind of complicated man he is. And they've just handled it, I think, so well. And yeah, if you're at all interested in, not even if you're grossed out by Dove Charney, this is interesting. So yeah, Startup by Gimlet. And then another podcast. Hannah, I think you have not recommended this yet, but I know you listen because your daughter turned you on to it. But Who Weekly, which is a great, funny podcast by Bobby Finger of Jezebel and Lindsay Weber, who used to work at New York. And I don't know where she is now, but they're both very funny. And it's a podcast about D-list celebrities, like the people where you say who, and they've divided the celebrity universe into who's and them's, and them's, you know, it's like the George Clooney's, and it sounds like a concept that would get old, but it doesn't. It just really doesn't. And so if you're looking for something funny these days, I wholeheartedly recommend it.
Yeah, she loves that podcast. She'll be delighted to hear that you like it, because she was like, oh good, respectable people listen to that podcast. That makes me feel so much better. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you to our producer, Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Our intern, Daniel Schrader, is this week finishing graduate school. Woo! Go, yeah. Daniel. It's an amazing intern. The XX Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply, our show page, slate.com/XX, where we list our recommendations and things we've talked about in the show. Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest, to continue the discussion and also recommend things that we might talk about. You can tweet at XXGabFest. And finally, subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts so other people can find out about the show. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen. We will talk to you again in 2 weeks.
Lady, don't you know we love you, sweet. Dear Mama. Lady.